Today, we have a guest that goes by the name of Evangel. We had to censor his name as he is an industry leader within the world of big tech and fintech. He has been close to the space of cryptocurrency since 2012, and he is here to share his insights and dive into the topic of the evolving state of the currency and what modern economic warfare looks like. This interview covered a lot of topics, and you may have to Google some of the terms, but Evangel performed very well in explaining the difficult things that we're talking about, and I hope you really enjoy this episode. So, let's go. Welcome, Evangel, to the show. It's an honor to have you on today, sir.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for having me.
You are very well respected amongst the crypto community. You've helped a lot of people with your insights. I'm really glad that my audience can come in and glean some information from somebody who's been involved in the space for quite a long time. So I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to share insights. I mean, I think as the space is evolving, more and more people really need to understand what they're getting involved with, because it's not the same as it was 5 years ago. And it most certainly wasn't the same as it was during the inception about 10 years ago. So yeah, I'm excited to share any insights and clarifications for your audience.
So basically the three topics that I would like to cover, and you're welcome to add to that, is basically we have a country that yesterday added crypto to the balance sheet as official tender. I'm also interested in the possible origins of crypto and also advice for people that are maybe interested in buying some and how to avoid being basically manipulated. So just maybe if you could give a quick introduction and about yourself. What you can, because obviously you're anonymous today, but and how you got into this space.
Yeah, no, it's there's a lot of exciting things happening. I mean, both good and bad in the space, from El Salvador really having Bitcoin as their legalized tender. I basically come from the tech space, right? I've been in the Silicon Valley space since 2012, been in the crypto space around just as long, and having, you know, the reason for being anonymous is cryptocurrency, as you know, is a very speculative topic, but also it's a very controversial topic within the tech industry. So, you know, being able to not shill a coin or shill a project or affect the marketplace would be in my best interest. Just also, you know, making sure that it doesn't end up on headlines or something within getting picked up by tabloids that so-and-so said, you know, that this coin is going to go up 100%. So that I'm just trying to give an educational basis on understanding the space, how it relates to technology and really the future of crypto. And I also personally believe, you know, Bitcoin as its own was really created for a P2P user basis, right? It was supposed to be free. It was supposed to be, you know, kind of frictionless between peers. And the way that it really evolved over the times and the way it kind of just changed is it's now becoming more and more involved in politics and economics. It's being involved in, you know, even the state of affairs with foreign nations. And I personally believe it's going to lead to what I like to call economic warfare. So I'm excited to talk with you today about these things, as well as give an overlay for the history of crypto, where I believe it's personally going, and how the world is constantly changing just due to the times and the current situation we're in, you know, with COVID and remote. You're talking about revolutionizing technology by, I want to say, 3 to 5 years ahead. Pre-COVID, a lot of CTOs, what they were thinking of doing were, you know, sandbagging and thinking of, hey, this is going to be our business plan for the next 3 to 5 years. Because of the coronavirus pandemic, CTOs are forced to act. They're forced to change their mindset. And, you know, what they originally had planned for three to five years, it's now. CTOs all around are discovering and they're discussing, how can we create a frictionless user experience, make it more seamless while simultaneously keeping our business afloat?
Absolutely fantastic. So you basically have given a lot of people, you know, anonymous advice on the markets, not advice, like opinions they say, but you've got sort of got a way of teaching that's I've found rare in other financial teachers. And you got a way of explaining it and breaking it down, which is kind of easier to understand, even though the topics you're talking about are very advanced. And sometimes I have to Google quite a bit of what you say sometimes. So I'm just thinking about this aspect of warfare. So they say that countries are never at a point of 100% peace or 100% war.
And right.
We've seen like economic warfare where countries have been made into debt and then basically their resources have been pillaged. How do you see that dynamic or similar dynamics working with cryptocurrencies? And as of yesterday, we have El Salvador using it as official tender.
Yeah, and I can kind of go into this because normally on paper, you know, a country adopting Bitcoin as a legalized currency tender is normally good news, right? You'd think it's a bullish news. You think, why is it going down? You would be very ecstatic to hear it should be going up. What's happening? But the reason being is because when you take we'll say limited resource such as Bitcoin and you're turning it into a legalized tender, the definition of tender, as Google defines it, is, you know, what it's used for is to settle any sort of public or private debt that meets a financial obligation, right? So this means tax payments, contracts, legal fines, damages. All this stuff is really what a legal tender is qualified as. So almost every country uses it as national currency. Now, when you take something like Bitcoin and you're doing this, not only are you looking for a lot of controversy, because we already know it's no stranger that Bitcoin is very volatile in the way that it just generally has been historically. And it's also no stranger to know that manipulation and market manipulation, as well as, you know, over leveraged positions, tend to create a lot of friction in the markets. So when you have a country like El Salvador, who's making historical moves here by really doing something like this, not only is there a lot more risk involved, because to get Bitcoin to where it needs to be, you need to have a centralized wallet that is, especially if it's a country, you have to have a centralized wallet that is able to give everyone access to that Bitcoin. Right now, as some of you may or may not know, El Salvador had a very rough rollout. The rollout for itself was very rough. And the reason why it was very rough was because they were having some glitches, and that may or may not have partook in the reason for the sell-off. But the main reason for the sell-off is because everybody was leveraged, overly leveraged, and they were overly leveraged to a point of where, you know, buy the rumor and sell the news, right? That's really the age-old principle. And when you have a country that's looking to do something like this, I want to open your mind to what the possibilities are. If we look at the Bitcoin market as a whole, before, you know, leverage or anything else was involved, the market was very much so simple, right? You buy low, sell high. You basically put in your order books. And then maybe there was some sort of, you know, bots or algorithms or whatever it was. But once you introduce, you know, CME, Bitcoin futures, and the ability to do leverage and liquidity pools and all this other stuff, it gets very, very complicated. So to simplify it, I'll give you an example. Before we even talk about a country manipulation so that you can have it exhibit A and exhibit B to go from, let's take Bitcoin miners. Now, maybe some of you remember the first relative dip, 15% that we got at the start of the bull run. And I think news then recently came out saying that, you know, F2 Pool, which is a very big, I think one of the biggest mining pools in China, they were the cause of the dip, or actors there were people who partook in having that dip happen. I think it was somewhere around 25,000 or so Bitcoin being sold on the open market. And it was right around the time of the futures, Bitcoin futures expiration as well.
When you say bull run, you mean was it March this year?
No. I'm saying this was at the start of the bull run this year. Yes, it was. I want to say it was about February or March. I want to say right. That was pretty much the time of when we had that. I think, believe it was February. We had that big dip. That was the first 15% dip. And I noticed something very, very irregular. There was a lot of outflows. There was a lot of inflows of Bitcoin. There was a lot of demand and positive news. So what could cause this dip, right? But if you look at Bitcoin as a source, if you have miners that are able to essentially mint this and print this, and you have some of the biggest miners in the world that have a lot of volume and liquidity, if you do an open market sell at 25,000 Bitcoins, let's say right now, like on a market sell, you're definitely going to cause a price dump, because that triggers everyone's stop losses, that triggers liquidity, that triggers liquidations. So there's a lot of things happening here. So if you think of it this way, CME, or Bitcoin futures, if you will, there's a lot of future exchanges, allows investors and individuals to basically go and place their bets on whether or not, you know, Bitcoin's going to go up or down. and they're going to open a futures contract. And pretty much by the end of that contract, whatever they bet the nominal was is what they're going to be rewarded with. So if you're a miner, a mining pool that has, you know, over thousands and thousands of Bitcoin, and you're able to create a down trickle of sell pressure, what happens is Bitcoin in itself is going to trigger a lot of these reactions in the market, causing a downward pressure. And if you were the person who initially started that, wouldn't the advantage be for you to open a short position while doing that? So if you open a short position, knowing that the market's going to go down, knowing that you're causing a lot of downward pressure and triggering a lot of sell-offs, wouldn't you then ride it all the way down with a short position and then basically open a long position on the way up?
It just so that's, seems so that's simple a, and easy to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a form of market manipulation. It's a form of market manipulation to where volume drives pressure. And if pressure is going down, the logical, whether you're having stop losses, whether you're using bots, whether you have something that's triggering, the logical answer is the majority of the retail market looks at Fibonacci's, right? They look at Fib levels. They look at a lot of these different TA readings. So if you think that, if you know that the majority of the people are looking at one specific thing, wouldn't it make all the sense in the world to take that specific support line where everyone's eyes were and basically just cause the dump right there? Because it's so unexpected. It's so out of the ordinary. And yet it's so simple and effective because you are causing a sell-off just so you can accumulate more Bitcoin on the way up. So how does this relate to El Salvador? Well, I just gave you an example of how this is possible from, you know, just the market dynamics themselves right now, because Bitcoin futures, perfectly legal, no laws against that. Miners operations, or at least before China started, you know, kicking miners out, perfectly legal, no, nothing against that. Volume, liquidity, all this is perfect market dynamics. So how does this relate to El Salvador? Well, now you have a country. Remember, Bitcoin futures, it doesn't restrict people. It doesn't restrict countries. It doesn't restrict entities. And the reason being is because there are no guardrails right now for cryptocurrency. Cryptocurrency is still a relatively unregulated market. As I'm sure you're hearing, a lot of regulations are being formed, and it's very hard to create regulations around crypto. It's because there's no guardrails. It's not like the traditional market to where it's heavily institutionalized. You have to play within specific sectors. You know, there's specific guidelines you have to follow. Crypto doesn't have any of that. So if I am a country, and I go in there, I could partake on CME, I could partake in different Bitcoin futures. I can take volume and liquidity. I can look at the charts like any other trader and basically see, hey, there isn't an overwhelmingly amount of over-leveraged positions right now. So wouldn't it be nice if I don't even have to move the market price by 1%. All I have to do is do a long squeeze, trickle down a long squeeze from all of those overly leveraged long positions and move the market just a little bit in order to create a domino effect. Almost like Django, where you're piling the blocks on top of one another and then you pull the wrong block, the whole thing topples over because now you're trickling all the sell-offs. What if I did that, but what if I partook in CMEs, had a short position opened, and basically just shorted it all the way down? Well, wouldn't that be nice?
CMEs?
CMEs is a Bitcoin futures. For some of you that aren't familiar, it is the main thing that caused the 2018 crash. CME essentially is one of the big, if not the biggest, foreign exchange company. It is for futures and options trading. And it is, let's just say, it provides leverage. It provides you being able to bet. So if I'm betting on Bitcoin, whether it goes up or down, I can create downward or upwards pressure based off of my bet, based off of how much liquidity I put in, based off leverage and everything else, to enable that contract to either be in my favor or be in someone else's favor. So it's basically betting on what the outcome is going to be. If you open a CME contract, maybe it's a weekly contract, maybe it's a monthly contract, you open a contract, whatever happens at the end, that outcome, whether you, let's say, for example, you bet Bitcoin is 45,000 and Bitcoin is maybe, I don't know, around 47,000. So you think it's going to be 45,000 by the end of month or something like that. And then someone else bets, oh, Bitcoin is at 45,000 right now. I'm thinking it's going to be 50,000. Well, you then take the liquidity in the market, right? This is where market manipulation and everything else happens. And you are basically able to move. This is why they call market movers. you're moving the outcome to the spot price, right? The spot price in itself of where the market is not the same exact as where CME is. And Bitcoin CME futures for CME group, it's cash settled. It's not Bitcoin settled, which means that there's a lot of money being made for Bitcoin futures on the CME. So CME is also, it's available for anyone who has the capacity to go and be opening these contracts. So if I'm a country, let alone the president of El Salvador, what is stopping me from doing something like this, right? And again, it's up for debate on whether or not they did something like this, whether or not they opened a short position, maybe knew for a fact they were going to impact the price because they saw that there was a lot, and I mean a lot of leverage, overly leveraged positions on the market. What's stopping me as a country from going, you know what, let me just create a long squeeze real quick because I know that there's a lot of people looking too short and just trickle a sell-off and basically ride it on the way down. And the only reason why I say this is because shortly after, El Salvador then announced they bought 150 Bitcoins and they bought the dip. Like shortly after, that means that someone was paying attention. And that means that someone was monitoring it because it wasn't like an hour after, 2 hours after. It was very, very soon after they announced that they bought more Bitcoin.
How easy do you think it would be to prove that they did that with the wallets and accounts that were doing that shorting? Could you link it back to El Salvador?
That's only if you know exactly what wallet they're using, right? And this is this goes into the whole thing of Algorand and why Algorand is has been showing a lot of momentum is because El Salvador is using Algorand as the core component for the wallet of choice. You know, that's a lot of the reasons for why Algorand in itself, if you've noticed the recent price action and momentum, it is a big portion of, correlation towards El Salvador's recent launch. And they're using Algorand in their wallet exposure. Like they're using Algorand itself within, I think the wallet in itself is called Coibanks. I think it's called Coibanks. And Coibanks, I think, is creating the wallet, and they're using Algorand as the core piece of infrastructure. Don't quote me, but I believe that's what it was.
And they're storing Bitcoin in that?
They're looking to use Bitcoin as the global distribution, right? Because remember, they went through several glitches on the day of launch, and it was a rocky rollout. It was really a rocky rollout. There was glitches, there was issues, and that may or may not have contributed to the sell-off versus amongst a lot of other things. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that equates to what you saw yesterday, right? It was over leveraged positions. It was buy the rumor, sell the news. But most importantly, who was the culprit and perpetrator of that? Well, Willy Wu, who some of you listeners may or may not know, a lot of great on-chain dynamics and metrics there. He believes that he spotted exactly where the discrepancies might have been. And he said that it's not from the long-term holders. It is from the people that are actually over-leveraged. And the over-leveraged pressure created a downward sell-off that was ultimately based off of a whole buildup of things that were happening, days prior. So a lot of factors come into this. And the reason why I say economic warfare is possible is because Bitcoin, as you know, is volatile in its nature. And if a country like this can participate in a futures exchange like CME, well, then who's to say that, they weren't the ones that helped trickle the sell-off so they could buy more Bitcoin? And why would they do this to themselves? Some of you may be thinking, well, why would you do this as a country? Why would you do this? Because it's ultimately going to hurt your economics, right? Well, yeah. That'd be true if Bitcoin was the only form of currency for that country. Mind you, El Salvador is still accepting US dollars. US dollars is still being accepted by El Salvador as a second form of currency. In fact, I believe the president is mandating that all merchants, vendors, and businesses take either Bitcoin or US dollars. Now, why would they do that? Why would they accept both of them if it wasn't for the fact that El Salvador knows that they can convert Bitcoin into more USD?
It just seems insane, man. Either they've got somebody at the top level that knows this stuff very well, or they're just doing gambling because, what average politician is going to understand what they're doing here?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it gets very, very complicated, which is why I said Bitcoin has come far and long ways from its Silk Road days to where it's at now. And ultimately, when you look at the actual interest and you look at the amount of intent that is around Bitcoin, everybody seems to think that it's this cycle, like, oh, El Salvador's crazy for doing this. But I look at it both ways. I look at it like on one hand, El Salvador is exposing themselves to very, very high volatility, like very high risk, very high volatility, and a large amount of manipulation. On another hand, El Salvador also has a catalyst right now that is capable of honestly minting more US dollars, like creating much more US dollars to drive their economy up, which is exactly why they're still accepting US dollars on top of Bitcoin. And as you know, like a lot of countries that have much more corrupted forms of government, such as Venezuela and other places, you know, they're looking at this and they're looking at this as a use case, which means that El Salvador, it really is just like Project X right now. It really is patient zero, because all these other countries that are dealing with, you know, worse situations, there may be a very big push for more adoption coming across. But where is the economic warfare then? Well, it's because if you have a country that's at the mercy of volatility, and you know how volatile the markets are to manipulation, and you know how exactly far extended things can be, you know, I'll put it this way. When Elon Musk was accepting Bitcoin, you know, he was revered, he was praised, like everything was going fine. And all of a sudden he backpedaled from, you know, saying that Bitcoin was not energy efficient, right? Not in part of, because Tesla's all about green. So the narrative obviously fit. But everything was fine. And then obviously he started moving Dogecoin, and it's still continuously doing something with Doge. So what I find really interesting, though, is months afterwards, it was actually reported that BlackRock was pressuring Elon pretty much in terms of, you know, making that move and accepting Bitcoin. And I don't know if there was any correlation for why Elon ended up saying the narrative he did, because it was very out of character, right? Even the way he wrote it was very almost like a notepad. Someone opened Notepad, typed it in, and then cropped it and then posted it. When he wrote that message, it wasn't a very traditional message. It was almost like he did it in a hurry. So whether or not there's any form of ground for BlackRock had any sort of influence on why he backpedaled, what I can say, though, is when BlackRock did pressure Elon, after Elon said what he said, BlackRock bought the dip. And not only that, they also bought a lot of mining stocks. So for those of you that aren't familiar with BlackRock, I encourage you to look up who they are. I also encourage you to look into the current housing crisis of the mandate of what is it called? It slips my mind right now. The evictions that are happening right now because it's being lifted. BlackRock is looking to pick up a lot of foreclosed homes. They're looking to pick up a lot of foreclosed houses, because what happens when people get evicted, banks buy up the property, and the property is then up for sale. And then you basically mitigate a housing crisis because there's a lot more supply and demand going on in the markets. In fact, why this matters is there's a big tech push right now for a lot of different, you know, cities down in the Midwest in the United States. And they're really looking to spread out to a lot of areas that honestly weren't really high and medium average living. But because a lot of tech companies are going there, the housing market's going up. Housing prices in Tennessee have blown up, way up. I was there about a week ago, and I couldn't believe the amount of development that was going on. So, yeah.
It's a shame, because the locals then get priced out of the market, you know?
Yep. Yep. People that have lived there all their lives get priced out of the markets due to development, due to, you know, just an influx of just revenue, you know, people that are coming in. And this is pretty much propping up the housing market, because BlackRock, as you know, it's an investment management company. And if you actually look at what they do, they look into all kinds of assets. They have, I think, over $9 trillion in assets. What's stopping them from buying foreclosed properties off of the banks? What's stopping them from, you know, being able to open this up and add more to their assets? Because as you know, real estate has always been king. And mortgage companies, you know, still on the topic of Bitcoin here, mortgage companies are starting to accept Bitcoin. Like some of the biggest mortgage companies, I think it was announced that some of the biggest mortgage companies will be accepting Bitcoin later throughout the year. I think it was United Wholesale Mortgage was one of them. And, you know, a lot of these other people are taking notice now. So it's a very interesting shift in dynamic. But it also leaves a lot of exposure when countries themselves are adopting it as a legalized currency tender.
Wasn't BlackRock started by just one guy?
BlackRock was started, I believe they've been around, well, they've been a staple name for a while now, but BlackRock, if I recall correctly, has been found by, I think it was a family. I believe BlackRock was a family company initially. I'm pretty sure it was a family-owned company. Could be wrong.
I saw a chart of like what BlackRock owned. It was unbelievable. They owned basically, they had their hands in almost everything I could
everything.
See. Everything. Yeah. Every company you can imagine, it's got its hand in.
Yeah. Yeah, no, 100%. 100%. BlackRock is definitely way up there in terms of, that's why, you know, when BlackRock was hinting that they were into Bitcoin, it did affect the price, right? Where all this really matters is the fact that when you have a country, because a country then turns into like a stock almost. Like if a country adds Bitcoin to their balance sheet, right? That's really what it is. If a country adds Bitcoin to their nominal currency in their balance sheet, it's almost like a corporation adding Bitcoin to their balance sheet.
Kathy Wright's country.
Yeah, right, exactly. And what I find really, really interesting about this is, because here's the thing, and I'll give this in retrospect right now. Corporations, I'm sure you guys seen Square or other people, they've owned, you know, they're starting to buy Bitcoin. The companies from all tech companies, whether it's a gaming company, entertainment company, digital company, software company, they're all looking into Bitcoin, adding it into their balance sheet. But here's what something I wanted to clear up, because a lot of people go like, oh, doesn't that affect the stocks? Doesn't that do this? Like, why would it be good for this? I'm going to open your perspective for a second. Let's say I'll use Square right now. Square owns about, I think, somewhere around 8,000 plus of Bitcoin. And I think they own around 8,000 or so Bitcoin. And, you know, it's only within, I think, 3-5% of their balance sheet, right? I'm not sure how much they put on their balance sheet, but let's just say how they've added it to their balance sheet. And then let's say on a quarterly earning, because let's take a look at Square's Q2 earnings report. That's something we could pull up. If I look at Square's Q2 earning report, one of the things that I will be able to find is, let's say they invested, and I'm going to throw numbers out. This is not statistically accurate. Don't hold this to ground. I'm just giving an example for audience sake. Let's say Square, out of the 8,000 something Bitcoin that they have, which equates to $300 million, right? They made, I don't know, 50 mil, let's say 200, let's say they made $100 million quarter three, because quarter three is almost up, but let's just say they made $100 million quarter three. They added 5% of that, like Bitcoin is 5% of their portfolio, and they bought Bitcoin at like $30,000 or something, let's just say, right? Let's just give those numbers for now. Well, 5% is still 5%, because the difference is the corporation in itself is generating money every single day, meaning that a live entity, a company like Square, a company like, you know, any company that owns Bitcoin is still making revenue every single day because it's a functioning business. So what ends up happening when, let's say at the end of the quarter, Bitcoin downperforms, let's say, for example, they bought at 30,000, and it dumped 5K. So they're, let's say Bitcoin's down to 25,000. Obviously it's not, but let's just say it's 25,000. Well, on paper, it may look like, oh wow, well, Square just lost the investment. Like, that's a bad investment for Square. Like, they bought at this price and now they're down. But when you add in the actual revenue of how much percentage they put into their balance sheet, 5% is 5%, meaning 95% of the other capital is not in Bitcoin. So their business, let's say, generated, you know, $200 million on that quarter. They just broke even, right? They broke even because whatever they put down, they basically broke even off the revenue, which means that they're going to make it back anyways next quarter. Next quarter, if they perform and they make another $200 million, well, they're in the green now. And Bitcoin, only 5%. But if Bitcoin now next quarter turns 40,000 and they bought it at, you know, 30,000, that $10,000, that means they just sandbagged a lot more profit from the previous quarter from Bitcoin because Bitcoin wasn't performing as well, but it's on their balance sheet now. Maybe that quarter it didn't do well, but the next quarter it not only covered the first quarter, but it also exceeded the second one because now that revenue trickles over. So I'm going to ask you, would you prefer to have a chance of a appreciating asset, right? It's the same as having cash in the bank. You leave your money in the bank, it doesn't do anything. There's no percentage, nothing really goes up. I mean, even savings accounts, the percentages are like really, really dead. But if you have a chance of an appreciating asset that's sitting on your balance sheet, meaning whether it goes up or down, 5% still 5%, but that 5% that you have has the potential to go up 200% plus in one quarter, wouldn't you take that over just having like $200 million in the bank versus having, you know, $200 million in an appreciating asset that has the potential to be $400 million the next quarter? Like, anyone would take that because as a corporation, you're generating income every single day. That's the difference. The difference is a corporation cannot be associated with an individual. Jack Dorsey cannot be associated with Square because Square is the corporation. Jack Dorsey is Jack Dorsey. Jack Dorsey as an individual can invest in Bitcoin as an individual, but a corporation adding it to their balance sheet is entirely different. Jack Dorsey takes a salary just like anybody else working at any corporation. Even if he's CEO, you take a salary from the corporation. So the actual company, Square, Twitter, all these guys, they have their own balance sheet and they have their own revenue quarter over quarter, which is why you have quarterly earning reports. And that's the idea I'm saying here is, for a corporation, it doesn't matter if it goes up or down because they're not looking at a quarterly, quarter by quarter performance. They're looking at the longevity of potential because three quarters out, let's say, for example, they bought Bitcoin at $20,000 and they're not like Bitcoin goes to $15,000 the next quarter, but all of a sudden goes to $30,000 the following quarter. And they bought the dip every single time it went down. What do you think is happening here? It means that even though they lost money on the first quarter, they're double, triple, quadrupling that revenue stream the following quarters. And even if they don't, the business itself is going to make up for that in lost revenue. That's how confident they are in their business, which is why 3 to 5% on a balance sheet really is nothing. Now, when you start talking about a country adding it to their actual legalized tender, that's when you start talking more than 5%. That's like 50-50. That's like 50% USD, 50% Bitcoin. And that is where things get interesting. Well, the way that they have it, and I don't know what they did specifically. I just know that for a currency, they're basically mandating people to only accept US dollars or Bitcoin. Nothing else. No other currency. So it might as well be 50-50, right? Because you're saying like only Bitcoin or USD, nothing else. So if that's the case, that makes things very, very interesting. Because
I guess if you compare it to their net worth or their GDP, like, or the market capitalization of all their houses and products and land, surely it can't be that. Yeah,
100%. But the whole move here, it's a very revolutionary move. Whether you look at the market going up or down, it is a very revolutionary move that in the long run is actually very good for crypto in the long run. Like if we look at 2018, when people were talking about, you know, CME and talking about Bitcoin futures and the market collapsing in 2018 and having Bitcoin go all the way to 3 to 4K. Well, if you actually look at the historical route of trajectory, Bitcoin has never truly fell below its previous all-time high. Its previous all-time high has always been the floor for the pretty much bottom of the support. And what I find very, very interesting from there is it seems to follow a math model. You know, it seems to follow a mathematical principle. And even at Bitcoin's lowest, which is around $3,000 to $4,000, I think way back in the day or at the start of the year, a lot of what I found really interesting was the actual movement of accumulation. As you know, private investors and all these other people that on one hand come out and say, yeah, we're not for Bitcoin. We're not doing this. We're not doing that. On the other hand, they're simultaneously buying it too. Why? Because there's no guardrails that has them classify as individuals. Like if JP Morgan all of a sudden added Bitcoin to the balance sheet, they would have to report that. Like, that has to be reported every single quarter. That is going to be public information, right? But if an individual citizen, Jamie Dimon, say, bought Bitcoin himself, he doesn't have to report that till tax season. He doesn't have to report that at all. He doesn't have to say or disclose that publicly unless he's looking to move the market up. One thing people need to understand is the platforms, the news, the media, the outlets, they're used as a form of setting up order books. And why do I say this? A good example, and I'm not sure if you remember this, but March 2020 was, you know, during the coronavirus pandemic and pretty much around that time, there was a guy by the name of Bill Ackman. Now, some of you may remember him. I'm sure you guys, maybe some of you know him as the notorious Bill Ackman, who made $2 billion off a short position in a 30-minute interview, right? Maybe some of you know that. How did he do this? Well, he went on CNBC and he basically went on live television and told everybody that hell was coming. He said, you know, he had this whole great story saying that there was a dark cloud coming and that there was all kinds of stuff happening and that, you know, we got to brace ourselves. His children were playing, but there was a big storm. He told everyone to shut everything down. He said hotels and everything was going to zero. I mean, he was making very, very outrageous claims, that, as it seems, but coming from a guy like Bill Ackman, it held a lot of ground. It held a lot of ground. And if you actually look at the interview and you look at the stock performances, they were dumping as he was talking. Like, they were dumping more and more as he was talking. And funny enough,
a massive short or something.
That's right. That's right. Jeez, and Bill Ackman, horrible, man. He's the CEO of Pershing Square Capital Management. He is a hedge fund manager.
All these
he's the founder of Pershing Square Capital Management. He's a hedge, which is a hedge fund management company. And everything that he's doing was entirely legal. Like, all he was saying was he was expressing his opinion. He's not telling people, oh, this stock is going to die. But his narrative in that 15 to 30 minutes was so moving, because you're listening to a hedge fund management that's a guy who's very much so well known. The CEO of the hedge fund, mind you, he went on CNBC with a $2 billion short position, a $2 billion short position, knowing the fact that his words are going to move the market. Doesn't that sound familiar?
Well, it's the same exact thing. Reputation, like, over that.
No. He actually did. He actually did, because funny enough, he went back on CNBC.
He didn't lose his reputation?
No. Because
that's
again,
sickening, man.
It's crazy, right? But this is the thing. He went on CNBC, shilled the position. He basically said, This is the reason for my trade. Like, he came on, he basically did all this with a smile. So he went on CNBC with a $2 billion short position open, said what he said, and he's entirely right. All he was doing was expressing his opinion. Like, they didn't say, hey, Bill, which stocks do you think are going to go to zero? Like, he basically was talking about his fear. He basically said that he's never had more than $200 in his pockets. And for the first time ever, he loaded up on cash. He basically said that, you know, everything's going to zero. He said that the president should shut everything down and, you know, we should all be very careful. Like, he did it in such a way that was very, very smart. Like, this is Bill Ackman is no dummy. He said it. The narrative was so perfect that there was no sign of where you can say, oh, he costed me all this money. He was like, no, I just spoke my opinion. You know, my narrative is that I personally believe that hell is coming. Whether or not you listen to me, it's up to you. And he's entirely right. You could do this. It's entirely legal. It's the same exact thing as miners right now being able to dump large amounts of Bitcoin onto the open market, cause a downward pressure, have a short position open, and then open a long. It's the same exact thing. It's just a different market, right? That's why I'm saying what he did was legal and what miners were doing are entirely legal. So as long as there's no guardrails around crypto, this is the level of manipulation that I'm talking about. That exists. Traditional markets have this level of manipulation, even with the SEC regulations, right? Traditional markets have, you know, look at AMC, look at GameStop, look at all this stuff that's happening. There's no law against it. This is for the first time hedge funds were looking to, you know, say like, hey, this is not legal, this is not da 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 da, and they were saying like, you know, they were upset about it. But in all honesty, there's no difference from the guys on Reddit, you know, that were in GME and all this stuff, doing what they did versus what the hedge funds do every single day. Well, the only difference is that they amass a lot more capital. Liquidity and capital is what runs the markets. And that's something that people need to understand. Like, it's exciting to get into a new evolving space like cryptocurrencies or, you know, digital assets. But the thing you really need to understand is when you hold leverage, when you hold mass amounts of capital, that's what moves markets. And it doesn't matter if it's a crypto project, doesn't matter what form of market it is, it's always going to be whoever holds the most amount of money, whoever has the most amount of liquidity, that's who's going to be able to move the needle for them to be able to get a jump. Retail traders, the retail markets in general, everybody is ultimately trading off of the market's movements, right? We're literally think of the fish that are at the bottom of the barrel looking to scrap all the different scraps that are dropping, whereas the sharks and the megalodons at the top are all, you know, chowing down. The small fish at the side are only eating the leftovers. And because the leftovers, you know, $100,000 to you, to me, you know, $200,000 or $1 million to the average person, it seems like, you know, they really made it. But to the big time guys at the top that are opening ridiculous amounts of Bitcoin future contracts, opening ridiculous amounts of leverage, you know, creating enough capital that could move entire markets, we're talking about money by the billions being moved. We're talking about large amounts, like millions being lost a day in a single trade, right? This is capital that people haven't seen before.
And in a sense, they're making money from the retail traders because that's where it's just a transfer of wealth from the retail traders to the hedge funds, and hedge funds against other hedge funds are not as smart as them.
Exactly. Yes, 100%. Because hedge funds, you know, there's this whole global narrative. Apparently, a lot of people were thinking, oh, the hedge funds are in a coup. You know, they're cooperating with each other to go against the retail market. It's not the case at all. It's the hedge funds are against everybody. They're against the competition. They're against other hedge funds. You know, it's a dog eat dog world. But at the same time, the retail market is just there to trade off of the movement, off the action, off of momentum. You're not really involved on the front lines on the actual movement unless you are one of the guys who have that amount of capital, who are doing those things, because that then you'd be a market mover. You know, then you would be someone who ultimately is not just a market maker, but the market mover. And essentially, you're able to move the RSI, the MACD, you know, pretty much put the pressure and paint the charts however you want, create whatever support lines you want that fit your narrative. The retail market is just there to pick up the scraps and profit off of whatever's there.
Insider trading not legal after you finish your all honesty there, you said?
Yeah. So the interesting thing is the United States recently barred leverage trading. Leverage trading was recently barred in the United States. The rest of the world is pretty much legal. I mean, I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with the exchange of FTX, but FTX is not usable by anyone in the United States. They have a very thorough KYC process. You have to have someone that's, you know, able to pretty much get you in there from the country that allows leverage trading. So US is really clamping down on leverage trading, and while the rest of the country is just overly leveraged. Why this is legal is simply because of the fact that market dynamics, you got to think of it, what goes up must come down. The market needs liquidity in order to move, right? If there's no activity, if there's no momentum, it's a zero-sum game, meaning your profit on your position is someone else's downfall. You can't have it both ways. You can't have it to where, oh, I'm making money. I'm making money and you can make money too. No, if I'm making money off of you, you just lost money because of me. And the market itself is a zero-sum game. So when reason why this is legal is because you need to have liquidity to go through the markets, right? There was a large case during the time of AMC and GME when this was happening, and people were making a big case going like, oh, you know, this shouldn't be legal for the retail market. And then the retail market was, oh, this shouldn't be legal for the institutions that are doing this on and on. But the reality of this is this entirely legal because the market needs it to function. If we actually look at what moves the markets day in and day out, if we actually look at how people are profiting, you look at your average corporation that has a 401k, right? Every single corporation, by law, I believe, has to have, I think it's by law, if not by law, by perks of reason of joining, they offer a 401k. That 401k, whether it's a 401k of ETFs or bonds or equity, whatever it is, it's an amalgamation of whatever's on the market. So if the stock market all of a sudden stops having activity, everyone else's 401k is also impacted. There's a trickle-down effect. And I'm not talking about trickle-down economics. I'm talking about a trickle-down effect of where reaction and causation are both correlated. when one thing happens on the actual markets, everything else will react to it, right? Like if we start getting political here to where the recent, you know, takeover in Afghanistan with everything that has been happening, you know, oil prices and everything else that, that has been going on, there's a very large concern here. There's a very large concern for a lot of things, a lot of resources that have been primarily in, you know, Afghanistan, even though Iran does hold the majority of the oil. It's a very large concern because of the fact of all the resources that are now being held hostage, which ultimately will have a dynamic effect to affect and impact the rest of the world. So what I'm getting at here is what seemed small at first, right? A little bit of liquidity here and there, a little bit of leverage trading here and there. It snowballs into something greater because leverage trading is ultimately borrowing with debt. And you're using the debt of what you don't have to be able to generate more and more and to be able to hopefully profit on a trade. But whatever you lose, let's say, for example, margin call, if margin call happens, what do you think happens? You know, margin call happens, you're looking at owing more than you had. And for crypto, that luckily that's not the case. You just lose your entire portfolio, right? But for traditional stocks, you end up losing more than you what you bargained for because of margin calls and because you are opening margin trades.
That's what could happen if you're shorting, right? If you're shorting times 10 and the stock goes down, like goes up 10%, then you've or 20% at the gap, you've basically lost double your investment.
Yeah. Yeah, we saw this happen earlier with a very big capital mat. Was it Archegos? I think it was Archegos that was happening there with Bill Huang. Remember that Bill Huang incident that was happening in China where it was like margin calls happened and he basically lost his shirt because he couldn't, you know, he couldn't fit the margin call and he was getting like, yeah. So things happen. Things happen. And one of the biggest things is, you know, the craziest amount of impact is the fact that even someone like Bill Huang from, you know, borrowed everyone, large losses on bankers from Nomura and Credit Suisse and all these other people, $20 billion in 10 days. That's nothing to sneeze at. That was margin calls. That was him over leveraging. That was him doing a lot more than he needed to, you know, being overly extended, right? This is the dangers of what it comes down to. So when people think about investors and people think about capital management and interest and asset funds and all this stuff, you really need to think about how much leverage are you exposing yourself to? And is it something that you can stomach? Because you as an individual have no business ultimately using leverage. Like
honestly don't understand retail traders that are using leverage because you can't stomach movements of like 40% or 60% in a day. So why even bother, you know?
But that's what also adds liquidity to the markets, right? You need that leverage. Like all these people that are ultimately over leveraging themselves, you know, getting caught in long squeezes or short squeezes if it's going up, that liquidity has to exist. It's got to exist somewhere. And that exists, that liquidity then goes back into the markets. So
when you say liquidity, like, you're meaning like market orders at a certain or stop losses being hit. Yeah. That's basically moving the selling from one person to another.
When I say liquidity, I'm talking about the actual money that's moving. Like if you open a, let's say 10x leverage position on 2 Bitcoin, for example, and you just 10x that Bitcoin, but you lost out on the trade, that's 10x plus what you had going back into the market. It's going back into the market liquidity for people to rebuy it, right? Buy it again, and then basically have it cycle over and over again with larger leverage, new more capital, more capital being invested and more things going. So you're really looking at what you're looking at here is a compounding effect of leverage stacking on top of leverage to where a point of where it ultimately, which is why a lot of these people call it the bubble popping. I personally don't believe it's a bubble. What I believe is, you know, if you want to talk bubble, all of Silicon Valley is a bubble. I'll paint it out there. If you want to talk bubble, also, Silicon Valley is a bubble because let's run through the cycle. You're an investor who bought an IPO. That IPO goes up 200%, let's say, and now you have enough capital. Maybe you start your own company. You create a startup. You're bootstrapped. You're basically creating a startup, technology startup, and you're now looking for investors to buy into your startup to create a Series A funding. And then once you do a Series A funding, you have enough funding to go and hire a sales team. marketing team, you know, whatever it is that you're doing to create a fully functioning business. And then you do Series B funding because you're growing, then Series C funding, then Series D funding until you go public again. And once you go public as a CEO, you're planning an exit strategy, right? Your exit strategy is either going to be, okay, I'm going to be acquired by a bigger company, or I'm going to go public and go onto the stock market. And guess what? You started as an investor. Now you are opening an IPO and someone else is buying into that IPO. And then the cycle rinse and repeats over and over and over and over again. The whole reason why there's been more IPOs in the last year than ever before is because there's such a high demand for people to put money into things that have the capability of only going up. Especially if it's, imagine a company that goes public, you're already at the bottom. You already went public. Like your opening price is going to be the lowest that it can be going. Maybe you'll go lower than opening price after the pre-initial pump, right? Then you got the sell-off and you got the balance, but you're already at the opening. If you just hold on to that now for a while, granted, if the market does well, you're going to be definitely in the green. You're definitely in the profit. That's why all these investors, these like Sequoia Capitals and, you know, Microsoft Ventures and Salesforce Ventures and all these other venture capital groups, they're looking for IPOs. They're looking for startups to put their money in because they know for a fact that when this startup goes public, they're definitely going to be getting, you know, IPO, and they're definitely going to be getting much more money back. And this is why more and more startups are going public, and NASDAQ is blowing up. Like the tech and medical space is blowing up simply because of this. So that's why I say if people are going to say Bitcoin is a bubble, then Silicon Valley is 100% a bubble. Like the entire tech space is a bubble. So that's kind of the narrative that I always pin there, and how Bitcoin and tech always has a correlation. Like if you look at what Bitcoin really is, it's a form of digital asset, yes, but it is a piece of technology. At the end of the day, it's blockchain. And even though blockchain doesn't need Bitcoin to do well, Bitcoin is the core component of what really introduced that aspect of it at the start. So it's very interesting, you know, the way that the market dynamics are working now, how politics are being shifted into this, a trader's mentality, you know, the average person and how from their home they can invest in Dogecoin at like a penny on the dollar, and then within, well, it goes up over 2,000% or whatever crazy amount, and they just flipped that $1,000 to $200,000. I mean, it's liquidity at the end of the day, but it's not surprising at all. Because market dynamics, they've always existed. Ever since the 1920s, the stock boom, they've always existed. They've only grown from there, right? Everything that's been happening has been like back in the 1920s, things were going up ridiculous, and it led to a full crash. And that crash led to the Dust Bowl era, which ultimately didn't end until World War II, which drove the economy again. So that ultimately led up all the way to the 1990s with all the stock havens, you know, like penny stocks and brokers that were basically making ridiculous amounts of commission off of the penny stock. So I tell people all the time, the market dynamic is always cyclical, and Bitcoin, crypto, it's a maturing market still. It's very much so in its infancy compared to gold and compared to, you know, equities and any other sort of capital markets that you look at. We're looking at 2.20 trillion overall market cap. That's absolutely nothing when you look at the size of all these other markets, especially the stock market, NASDAQ and S&P 500.
Yeah, I saw a picture of like that 2 trillion compared to all the assets in a diagram. I'm unbelievable, like versus quadrillions of assets, you know?
Yeah, so a lot of these things that are happening, people go like, it's been around for 10 years. It's 10 years is nothing, to be honest with you. You know how long it took. If you look at the first 10 years of NASDAQ and look at the first 10 years of S&P 500, a lot of growing pains, but a lot more room for growth. And in my opinion, hyperinflation is inevitable. You know, that's something that ultimately will happen. Whether people want to believe it or not, inflation is a real thing. Just ask your grandparents. They'll tell you, you know, back in their day, they were able to buy groceries for pennies on the dollar compared to today. It's very real, and it's only going to continue to happen.
Cool. So let's go back to a more kind of conspiratorial type ideas. Let's talk about, and also warfare. So How much of a chance do you think that the Bitcoin was created for, say, a world government to eventually have some, they've lost control over the markets, over the financial system? Do you think it could have been created by a government or an international organization to eventually gain control of the world?
Yeah, no. Good question. It's actually really surprising because a lot of people do ask this. What I find really interesting is there's been rumors, right? Black ops, all these other people. A lot of people say that, oh, you know, Satoshi wasn't the true creator. It was involved in some sort of black ops project to fix the financial crisis, or, you know, Bitcoin was originally a CIA project and all this stuff. My whole breakdown here is let's start from the side and remember that Bitcoin in itself was only a thing after the during the period of the 2008 financial crisis. Like, this is something that is a given, right? It is something that was compounding, was impacted. And I believe the first block in itself was talking about the chancellor and the banking system and how Satoshi Nakamoto, the entity, really wanted to put that there as a caveat for people that could find it. There's also, as you know, rumors of where people are saying that, you know, MasterCard and all these other companies already infiltrated Bitcoin way back in the day. It's already being controlled by banks. Both arguments, you know, although up in the air, very plausible with the way that our I guess you could say, federal economy works, especially in the United States, for the checks and balances, as well as the many tendrils that break into the many different sources of the financial equity markets, right? So I think there's definitely a push for crypto to do well. And the reason why I say this is because Biden recently announced that his infrastructure plan was going to be funded by crypto taxes. And all of a sudden, there was a larger push for people to also simultaneously do a global tax, right? Global tax on all foreign nations. And I think Janet Warren, she was the one who wanted to ultimately push this forth. You got to think to yourself, the amount of money that we printed, amount of QE, quantitative easing that we've instilled in the last 2 years or so, ever since the COVID-19 pandemic, and how over $6 trillion and more have been printed, have been utilized, and yet the state of the economy is still where it is, while still having, for the most part, an ongoing pandemic. So I do believe that there are greater forces pushing Bitcoin to be a form of catalyst that can be accessible to a lot of these entities. Because institutional investors have to be allowed to go into the space, right? It's because they're institutional investors. And Gary Gensler and all these other people, you know, the Fed chairs, they haven't specifically just banned Bitcoin outright, and like they did in gold way back in the day. They haven't specifically shut it down, right? They haven't specifically done anything that has been out of the blue when they could have just as easily done so. Which begs the question, for why? Why would you allow an asset like this, knowing it's volatile, knowing how much people are making off of the US dollar, by the way, because at the end of the day, Bitcoin is pegged to the USD. What exactly would you gain from this? And the answer is, in my opinion, it would be a revenue pocket. A revenue pocket that not only is able to grant certain countries, cities, states, entities, more capital, be it taxes, be it, you know, crackdowns, whatever it is, it's just more liquidity for propping up the markets. Because if we're being honest with ourselves, there's been a lot of activity, a lot of things in bills, a lot of things being pushed forth, at least in the United States, that have been very sketchy at best in terms of why is this being put there? You know, why is this something that is being instilled there in a 500-page report when this is supposed to be a COVID-19 stimulus bill? Why, what relevance does this have to anything. And it begs the question on what else is being put in there. So do I believe that there's greater forces, you know, pushing forth and allowing Bitcoin to have this level of dominant impact? Yes. Now, is it right to say that I know who the entities are? And is it right to say that, you know, the conspiracy hole, oh, it's the Rothschilds, or oh, it's this person, or there's the global banks or the world reserves, or, you know, Satoshi himself, or Satoshi was a bank person himself. Like, it's very hard to convey that message. But I will agree that markets don't just move. You need money, interest, as well as demand to move it. And if the United States or China or anyone else really wanted to kill Bitcoin and shut it down, they would not have had a, what I call a yes and moment, which is ultimately dancing around very fine lines of regulation towards crypto. So it begs the question of why is this being allowed, and who has the best interest in this? Because remember, like I said, governments are dealing with large, large funds. They're not dealing with $100,000 or even $100 million. We're talking about $100 billion plus. We're talking about trillions of dollars of capital and equity that they could manifest within a GDP and print out from, you know, if they were not to paper, to print out. So the question itself is really to think about, hey, who's making the most here out of this? Because the retail market might make a couple hundred thousand or a couple million dollars. But the governments themselves, they can make billions of dollars off of the taxes, off of things alone. You know, they can make billions of dollars just without any of the risk. They're not taking any risk by putting tax on it. That's just free capital for them to be able to take from. The majority of the people that are taking the risk are the individual investors themselves. It's the same exact thing as, you know, the tax system as a whole, right? You do all the work. You're working a 9 to 5, you know, you're putting everything in there. And all of a sudden that money's just being taken from you. They're not doing any work, but it's being taken from you. So what difference is it with you investing, taking on all the risk, maybe even so much risk that it's dangerous, but then the government just coming in and collecting and saying that you owe us this because it's tax. In my opinion, it becomes another pocket of revenue for them to pull from to be able to fund whatever it is that they want to fund. So that, sure, that's kind, I
mean,
of
as long as the citizens are making more money than the other people, otherwise they'd be losing money and then they'd get less tax, right?
Yeah. 100%. 100%.
The way I look at it is, like, it seems to me like it's a pyramid, and you have these few whales at the top that have bought in early, and they're the ones that are manipulating the market and taking more money from retail. So in a sense, you could control the world eventually if you keep flipping the market dynamics, triggering, you know, liquidations on longs and then buying the dip. And if you keep doing that over and over again, more and more retails and more even governments or companies are going to be losing money. And you basically get this concentration of wealth at the top if there's a bunch of whales at the top that are in sync.
Yeah, and that's how it's been since the beginning of time. It's been like that since, as far as I can remember, from... If you look at who controls the actual equity, the markets and stocks right now, if you have to look at what is running what right now, it is very clear. You know, companies like Citadel, right? Citadel, you have all these other hedge funds and investment bankers and other companies that ultimately have the best and highest interest in making sure that they have a lot of leverage. And when I talk about leverage, I'm not talking about leverage in the sense of, you know, adding leverage to your position. I'm talking about leverage in the sense that they have the choice to ultimately be able to paint the narrative. Like, Citadel is never going to go belly up unless they do something ridiculously stupid, you know, or a company or a big hedge fund.
Is that like BlackRock? Citadel?
Yeah. Citadel is another very, very big entity. I recommend you guys
outside the back. Isn't like fireworks, by the way. That's what.
Yeah. No. Citadel LLC is they own a lot. They're a hedge fund company as well, so they own a lot of capital. They're not as big as BlackRock. Nowhere near as big as BlackRock, but Citadel is a hedge fund.
Cool. So we've covered a lot. Actually, it's been great. We've covered the a little bit of economic warfare, and that's going to be evolving, as you know, it's only the second day that a country's been using it. We've covered a little bit about that idea of conspiracy. We've talked about hedge funds, we've talked about market manipulation. I guess where do you want to take it, depending on how much time you've got?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm you know, one of the main things I want to leave off with is really that you got to look at adoption, right? Even a country like El Salvador, you got to give it a 6 to 8 week period to really look at what that legalized tender means, simply because that is the fiscal, that is the quarter. We are at the, I want to say towards the end of Q3, quarter four starts next month. Looking at how this country is able to, what they're able to do with having these legalized tenders, looking at what they're able to access and, you know, performance wise, how this wallet ultimately works out, I feel it's going to have very interesting shifting dynamics for the other countries that may be able to also benefit. I mean, if you look at the terrible things that are happening at Venezuela, for all the Venezuelan listeners, I really don't have to tell you how corrupt and unfair, you know, some of these politics are, as well as the government and monetary policies. So if it does pan out well for El Salvador to be some potential, you know, use cases of where other countries can also adopt a similar practice and get themselves out of a similar situation to where they're in, it may fare well for Bitcoin. What I really am going to find fascinating is, because Bitcoin is limited in supply, it is a limited supplied resource that ultimately has a halving period, the longevity, long-term impact of more and more countries taking in Bitcoin as a legal tender is going to be interesting for the future. Because if you look at it right now, if Bitcoin is so limited in supply and it ultimately becomes, and again, I'm painting a hypothetical here, it ultimately becomes that, oh, wow, countries have to adopt this as a national currency that's pegged against the dollar. Or if you look at CBDC, which a lot of central bank digital currencies are starting to kind of pave way. I think Europe is working on a lot. I know United States is working on some, and I know China is definitely working on some. What's really interesting here is the dynamic between decentralized finance, which is DeFi, platform networks like Ethereum, protocols that fit within the Ethereum ecosystem, and how well that ties to CBDC and where Bitcoin kind of falls. Because here's my thoughts.
What do you mean by CBDC?
CBDC is the central bank digital currency. These are the stable coin type of coins that are being issued by banks to ultimately be pegged towards what would be the dollar. But what'd be very interesting is if Bitcoin actually ends up becoming that reserve, because everyone talks about Bitcoin as digital gold, right? So if Bitcoin were to be
digital, not Peter Schiff, right?
yeah, exactly. But if Bitcoin were to be digital gold, what you're really looking at here is a peg towards Bitcoin. Like if CBDC was tied to Bitcoin and Bitcoin was tied to the country's currency, like a dollar or something, it would basically be the same as tying the US dollar back on the gold standard from when Richard Nixon took it off the gold standard in 1971.
I'm going to send this podcast to Peter Schiff, and hopefully you'll listen to it.
Yeah. Yeah, but 1971, for everyone that isn't familiar or not from the States here, you know, President Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard for the exact same reasons that we are in danger today. He took it off to combat inflation because he wanted to stop foreign countries from taking the dollar and converting it to gold and basically trying to do this rinse and repeat over and over again. He took it off the gold standard, which ultimately hurt the US dollar because the US dollar is now just printing, right? It's just printing paper. It's not tied.
He hurt the other holders of other countries more than it though.
Yep, exactly. It was a monetary policy move, and it was a move that ultimately changed the way the dollar was forever. So by hooking it up, and this is a hypothetical scenario, by hooking it up back to Bitcoin and having CBDC tie back to Bitcoin, so the CBDC is going to be one-to-one to Bitcoin, and that Bitcoin is going to be, you know, tied to the country's national currency, it would be similar to putting the dollar back on the gold standard, right? And is this going to be a possible future. Well, I have a few concerns about this. Like, would it be a future that'd be interesting? Absolutely. But what I have a few concerns of is the fact that no country is ultimately going to ever have a treasury reserve like Bitcoin to not be able to control. And what I mean by that is it's far easier to print with a printer than it is to try to manipulate Bitcoin. Because if Bitcoin, the way Bitcoin was built was to be, you know, for the people, by the people, peer-to-peer, it was supposed to be frictionless, you know, decentralized, and pretty much true libertarian, right? That's really what it was for.
It's the opposite of that almost now.
Yeah, it's the opposite of that almost now is because of the fact that of the way liquidity works. Like I told you about the example of if you have billions and billions of dollars, it doesn't matter if Bitcoin was made to be decentralized. You just have to own a majority of supply.
I mean, surely Satoshi had to be smart enough to realize that was a risk.
I believe so. I believe so. And this is why this topic is so interesting is the fact of, you know, Bitcoin was actually made, the amount of supply that it has. Someone did the math here. I forgot who it was off the top of my head, but someone did the math here. And ultimately, Satoshi, his famous last words were, Bitcoin's either going to go to zero or infinity. Like there's no in between here. There's no in between. It's either going to go all the way up to the top or it's not going to be used at all. And one of the interesting things is the amount of supply in Bitcoin. Someone did the math here. It was created to have exactly to where one Bitcoin was worth $1 million. Like it was, that was the amount of supply. So when the final Bitcoin is printed and minted, the net overall average of how much Bitcoin should be worth is supposed to be $1 million when that last supply is minted.
Would that be the market cap of the world?
That would be per Bitcoin. That would be per Bitcoin, $1 million per Bitcoin based off the amount of supply it has. And what I find this interesting is because this is not like an estimate or a guesstimate or anything like that. This is if momentum continues the way it has been based off of the amount of supply that exists, like the amount of supply that actually exists for where you can get Bitcoin, it would equal to $1 million per Bitcoin. And that means that Satoshi had to have purposely created this to have that impact. So it's something to think about, right? It's something to think about for the actual reasoning of where this is going to go. And banks, you know, financial players, a lot of people like to think, oh, you know, we're smarter than Bitcoin. No, financial institutions, they know this game better than you do. You're literally just living in it. They do this professionally. They've done this for years. They've done this for centuries, some might even say. And, you know, some of the oldest banks know this better than anybody else. We look at the recent redistribution. It was a clear Wyckoff distribution method, right? If you're looking at charts, any seasoned trader from traditional finance would look at that and go, oh, it's a Wyckoff distribution pattern. Whereas the retail market had no idea what they were looking at. They just thought it was like, oh, it's a downtrend. We're going back to 2018. No, it's a Wyckoff distribution and you just got Wyckoff distributed.
What can you like quickly explain what that is, a Wyckoff distribution?
Yeah. So Wyckoff distribution is an age-old trading pattern. It's off of market volatility, right? Like Wyckoff, for those of you that don't know, it was created by a man way back in the day during the golden ages of the stock market, if you will. And the reason for this is he wanted to teach the market something. So he created something called the Wyckoff distribution method, right? There's the whole write-up that you can read about this if you look it up. But Wyckoff in itself was meant to teach the market. Those that actually understood the lesson would profit from the market. He would call this the straw man because everybody would talk about the collective they, right? They would talk about, oh, they did this and they're doing this and they're manipulating the market and they're doing this. But who is they? Like there's this collective they entity that you always hear of. So Wyckoff wanted to create the principle of, you know, they would be what he would call the straw man. The straw man is someone who isn't a single individual, but is basically like a group of people, essentially, that are market movers and market makers. He wanted to create the concept of where, whether you are learning from what the market's trying to teach you, you'll profit from it. But if you're ignorant, and if you get selfish, and if you basically get greedy, well, you're going to get taught a lesson from the market by being sold off on. So the Wyckoff distribution itself is actually something that's been age old. And if you look at when Wyckoff started, the principle of Wyckoff itself was from Richard Wyckoff. He was, I want to say, he was born 1873, and he was a stock market investor because, you know, that's all there was back then. And this is something that was, like I said, around the 1920s, 1930s, to where it's a technical analysis method. It's a TA form that every single person should be familiar with, or I guarantee you, you will be distributed on again.
Okay.
And the recent pattern, the recent pattern of, if you look at the year to date in terms of Bitcoin, if you Google Wyckoff distribution, you will see it clear as day. This is a Wyckoff distribution in the making for long-term patterns. And if you look deeper and deeper into the market dynamics, remember, no one ever knows if the market's going up, down, sideways, front, or whatever it is, but you can lead off of the indicators. So the Wyckoff distribution ultimately is a pattern that forms based off of overall market momentum, meaning that if there's a certain level where people believe, okay, this is it, this is the final support line, and market movers decide, you know what, I'm going to sell off right here, I'm going to accumulate from there, I'm going to do this, that, and the other, they can't exactly create the narrative saying exactly this is what's going to happen, but they can influence it. Because again, it goes back to volume, right? It goes back to how much Bitcoin do you have to influence price momentum. If you have more Bitcoin than the average investor and the average seller, well, you definitely are going to be able to move the markets. So it comes down to a form of not just supply and demand, but it really comes down to how much am I able to move the markets and why? And what is the narrative that I'm trying to paint here? So there's a lot to be looked at, especially when it comes to traditional markets or, you know, crypto markets or any markets in general, whether you're in resources for gold, you're able to see age-old patterns. And a lot of seasoned investors, a lot of seasoned traders are coming into the crypto space specifically because it reminds them of the golden days, right? This is a young market, a lot of liquidity, large amounts of profit gain, max pain losses, max pain gains, like a lot of just all around with huge, huge growth potential. This is like the early days of the stock market. And this isn't going to be forever. Like, it's not special to crypto for this type of momentum. The only reason why crypto moves the way it does is because it's such a unmatured market. It is a maturing market, but it's an unmature market to a point of where there's a lot more growing pains it has to go through for it to get to the capacity of gold, for it to get the capacity of the overall S&P 500 or NASDAQ. There has a lot of, you know, there's a lot more years of growth that it needs to go through. So you're going to have a lot of volatility until the market matures more and more. The game here is about market maturity, and you're not always going to have this volatility. So the volatility only exists because crypto is such a young space and there's so much movement and momentum and, you know, money to be made there. But it's not going to be that like that forever, which is exactly why I tell people all the time, you got to look at the markets as if, okay, what is my game plan here? Like, what's my cost versus exposure, right? And this is not financial advice. You know, I'm not a financial advisor. It's not financial advice, but you got to really look at cost to risk exposure. How much am I putting down right now? What is the overall capacity in terms of loss for my time? If I'm chasing a knife that's basically going to give me $1,000 in profit, but I have to risk, I don't know, 2x, 3x that trade isn't worth it.
Right.
Right. That trade is not worth it. That leverage position is not worth it because I overexpose my risk more than what I can gain. So yeah. a lot of traders, unfortunately, don't think this way. They think about the short-term time frames and they're not looking at the macro dynamic movements. Whereas a lot of these bigger players, they're not looking at the minute charts. They're not looking at the 10-minute, the 15-minute. They're not looking at the 5 minutes. They're looking at the macro trends. They're looking at, okay, what's my appreciation if I were to buy this right now? Because a lot of people seem to project to go like, oh, why would an institution buy a 50K? An institution has billions of dollars to spend. That's number one. They have millions of dollars that they can move around and they have a lot of capital that they can also make back because again, it's a business. Institutions are businesses. They're not people, they're businesses. There's people at institutions, but these are individual investors, right? It's different from a corporation investment. You got to really stop projecting your wallet on the overall actions from bigger players. And that's something that a lot of traders make the mistake of, to where they go like, oh, this looks like a lot. No one's going to buy because it's a lot. Whereas the over average institution is going like, yeah, this is fine. I'm just going to make it back in 3 quarters from now or whatever it is. So cost of risk exposure, very, very important to know. And I think it's very, very important to assess your exit plan and your exit strategy. Like, what is your liquidity, first off? Like, how much can you invest, right? And based off of how much you can invest, what's your cost to risk exposure before you lose your shirt? And that's something that, because this market is so young, a lot of the older players, they come into this market knowing that a lot of people don't think that way. So it's easy pickings.
Yeah, man. So another topic I'm thinking about with Bitcoin, like, so El Salvador.
Yep.
The potential is to reduce crime because you have these addresses and you can tie it to people's KYC. I don't think it will work that way, but there's a potential that way. But what I'm worried about is eventually if we go cashless, then every citizen is under... They're basically controlled by the internet access. There's no internet access. They can't buy. They can't lose a Bitcoin. So I'm always afraid of the governments having too much control. And if currency becomes legal tender, then in a sense, they could have like only official wallets that you can use. You know, that you have to register your wallet with the government before you can use it. So you can just imagine like this whole decentralization thing is faded, and then cash will be valueless. So that's what I'm worried about as well.
Yeah, and that brings up an interesting point. So one thing I didn't mention was the interest of blockchain for nominal governments, like China, for example, which is experimenting right now with their own version of a CBDC, or a digital yuan, if you want to call it that, is blockchain has the ability to set you free and be the most transparent thing that you can think of, but it also has the ability to really enslave and pretty much, you know, keep track of everything more tight than ever before. Right. And I want you to think of it this way. Imagine a country being able to not only know, because with cash, guess what? You can hide cash, right? Because cash businesses, you know, you go off the books, you could very much hide cash under your mattress. The government doesn't know that. They can't really scale that, you know, to a large majority of places that can keep track of cash, right? They can't do that. But if everything is on something they can track, imagine being able to freeze your assets, meaning like, hey, we don't like what you did here. We don't like what you said here. We don't like what you, whatever it is. Imagine being able to just, that's it. Okay. You don't have money any, like your money is frozen now. You have no more money because you said this. And as a government, you know, because I'm not using cash anymore. I'm using something that everyone can track, which essentially would be a digital form of currency. Not only am I able to keep track of what you do with your money, but I'm also able to control the outflow and inflows of where money goes, meaning that you can't hide cash anymore. You can't do anything that you used to do anymore. It is all reported. It is all recorded and it is all held. So that's really the scary part of blockchain, is that it allows the capability of that, right? It allows the capability of having full tracking, full control, full, you know, for a user experience, really being under the gun and always being watched. That's kind of the dystopian fear that a lot of people that are in the crypto community have. But I also see that this ultimately will bring a larger conversation on the table, right? For instance, you know, this is where guardrails, like regulations and certain things need to be instated for entire countries not to be turned authoritarian this way. Yeah. Like, I could see a lot of countries turn authoritarian by having this level of power. Imagine just being able to not have access to your money now because you said something bad about the government, or you said something wrong, or maybe you owe taxes, or maybe you did something bad. And instead of them sending you a ticket, which they normally do, you basically just have no access to your money. So you're forced to comply.
It's like having no guns, but then having no money as well.
Yeah, exactly. That's a dystopian scenario. Is it very possible? Yes, you know, unfortunately, I'll say it right now. There's nothing stopping people from doing that. There's nothing stopping people from preventing that from happening. The only thing that can stop that from happening is if there is some sort of checks and balance system, of where you can keep that at bay and you're able to balance out the power.
It's almost like a global world government though to do that.
Yeah. Exactly. And this is why I'm saying that for countries to adopt Bitcoin as a legal tender opens up a lot of very interesting scenarios. Because now you have entire countries talking about like, okay, how do we guard this? How do we create guardrails for this? We can't have one country going, manipulating their currency and generating more US dollars and, you know, doing all this. Like, what do we do here?
It's going to but be then a we also can't, another.
Yeah. It turns into a bigger conversation. And it also turns into almost as if we're building a new branch of checks and balances, right? Because our government, if you think about our government, you got the senator, you got the Senate, you got Congress, you have all these other people that pretty much are mitigating and making sure that the president's not just sending in all these crazy orders, right? You have the ability to veto, you have the ability to impeach, you have all this stuff that's pretty much there to ensure that tyranny doesn't happen, right? And that's in the United States. I'm talking about specifically the United States. This is the checks and balance system. What is the checks and balance system for crypto or for digital currencies? Forget crypto, just digital currencies in general, to keep people from being abusive. That is going to be the larger conversation that, in my opinion, El Salvador being, you know, taking this as a legal form tender is going to enable. And that's why I'm saying that this makes things very interesting. Where is this going to go? It's anyone's guess, right? It's anyone's guess where this is going to go. But I could tell you right now that Bitcoin, as I said from the start of this conversation, has come a long way since the Silk Road days. And it's only going to move further and further to become more and more of a political war piece that may or may not have the ability to ultimately drive a lot more potential damage than it already has, than we already have. Not it already has, but we already have. Because Bitcoin itself has the ability for the best in the world, but also the worst in the world, right? It's ultimately up to the users and the people on how they use it. It's all subjective, you know, down to how people use it, where it comes from, what the intent is. Same thing could be said for guns, right? Guns typically don't kill people. People kill people with the gun. The gun is an item, you know, but people have the intent to kill with the item. But then also people could debate and say, well, the gun was created to kill in the first place and all this stuff. But ultimately it comes down to the user. It comes down to the person behind it. So Bitcoin at the end of the day, it is a technology. It's an exciting technology. Blockchain is an exciting technology. It comes down to what is our intent and who is using it.
Yeah. So in conclusion, I hope that cryptocurrency can be used for good. At the moment, I'm more on the negative side. I think that basically two influential people that I have, their content, you know, for example, what's his name, the guy up in Scotland, Dan Penner, he says that if you knew who created Bitcoin, you'd be terrified. And then there's a lot of information that's out there that's basically saying it's potential new world government, but hopefully it's not, and it can be used for, you know, people to transact cheaper than the amount of money that they're spending on fees and banks, and people preserving themselves against inflation, protecting themselves. But as you say, nobody can really predict what's going to happen, and this situation evolves daily, if not by the in 20 minute periods. History can happen in 20 minutes with, as we saw yesterday, in many levels. So
yep. And that's why it's exciting times. But yeah, I want to thank you again for having me. I know it's a very touchy topic for a lot of people, but I felt it was important to educate the masses as more and more people are diving into this new space. I think there's a bright future for crypto, but I also think there's a lot of risk involved. So yeah, thank you so much for having me as a guest.
Yeah, thank you, Evangel. It's been a pleasure, and I'd definitely like to have you on again. You're definitely one of the best, if not the best analysts in the world on this topic. Is there a way for institutions or companies to reach out to you?
Yeah. And I mean, in the spirit of holding anonymous, I think if you have any inquiries, if you wanted to drop a call to action to reach out to you to get in contact with me, I'm happy to have a private discussion in that shape, way, or form.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I'm always happy if anyone's looking to get into the space and just needs a little more of an understanding of what the risk is involved. I think, you know, I'm happy to have that conversation and we could talk offline. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. See you around.
Bye.
Thanks everybody for listening to Nico's show today. That was Evangel, and we'll see you again shortly. Bye-bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the Nico's show. I trust you enjoyed its content and were transported on an adventure. If you are a world-class expert in your field or you know one, please get in touch. I'm also looking for long-term partners to sponsor the show. Please share with your friends if you like this episode, and please leave a rating and leave a review if you haven't done already. See you again soon. Nico's out. Bye-bye.